So sorry about the technical delays. When nobody was in the room and I plugged in the HDMI, everything was perfect. And then when we switched to the regular VGA connection, something went badly wrong. Anyway, here we are. It's a real pleasure to visit Perimeter for the first time. I want to thank Daniel for inviting me and all of you for coming. This is going to be an unabashedly or unashamedly, at least at the beginning, philosophy talk. And that has both good and bad aspects. So you're not going to learn any physics today. But on the other hand, you'll really follow everything that's going on. If you don't, please do stop me. And with 1 minute's clarification, we'll all be set. But what I'm going to be talking about today, well, let's see. My aims are these. I want to discuss the latest twist in a traditional debate between perspectives on what's the nature of space and time, or space-time, the fight between those who prefer a relationist or a relationalist perspective and those who instead prefer an absolutist or substantivalist viewpoint about the ontology, the question, what is space? Does it exist as a thing? Right? So the absolutist or substantivalist view is, I guess, pretty clear. Well, actually, I'll just get through my aims first and then come back to that. The latest twist being something that Harvey Brown and some other philosophers have started to advocate, and they call the dynamical approach to space-time. It's the main topic today. What I want to do is argue that some of the main claims of the people who advocate the dynamical approach can really be disputed and are interesting to think about and see whether they hold up, and suggest my own view that if you're attracted to a relationist agenda, I'll say what that means in a second, then the dynamical approach, which is a kind of modern day relationism, is probably not the most promising way you want to look at it, but that will be very quick and at the end. So as I'm saying, the background of today's talk is this traditional dispute that goes at least back to Leibniz versus Newton, between a perspective that space or space-time in more recent times is a kind of a thing that's a part of reality that has its own kind of existence independent of matter. So that, for example, it's possible to conceive of a world with just space-time and nothing else, no fields or matter in the traditional sense, versus the relational perspective that wants to downgrade the reality of space or space-time. And the relational perspective actually is not a positive thesis. The way I think of it, and I've argued this in print, that the only thing that unifies relationists is that they don't like absolute space. So it's really a thesis that's about the denial. We got to find some way of doing without this absolute character. Now the more recent 20th century history of the debate among philosophers features these kind of main stages. In the 1970s, after a long sort of decline, John Ehrman, Michael Friedman, and others really strongly defended that absolutism or substantivalism was the only kind of plausible interpretation to take if you think about general relativity, special relativity, or classical physics. And then the same Ehrman came up with a funny argument after people discovered basically the same argument in Einstein's writings, historians of physics, discovered this whole argument in the context of a generally covariant theory and used it to argue that substantivalism is actually a problematic position about space because it leads to some sort of radical indeterminism. Fortunately, we won't have to talk about that today. And then things died down after that debate, and then the most recent sort of new philosophical approach comes out of the work of Harvey Brown primarily, and I know many of you know Harvey, but other people have worked on it. His co-author for several papers, Oliver Pooley, shares many of the theses we'll be talking about today, but also the work of Nick Huggett and Robert DeSalle, my colleague at Western. They all kind of push along this in the same directions. So what is this new idea? And of course, like any new idea, it probably has antecedents in Poincaré or something else like that. But it's a recent revival, at least. Yeah.
Just a clarification, when you contrast space-time with fields and matter, Are you including, which side does the gravitational field or the metric field go on?
I'll tell you that two-thirds of the way through. So, no, it's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, if I have to reveal my hand.
Oh, okay. It's,
no, it's that's something that's crucial to understanding what this dynamical approach means or whether it's plausible for a general relativity type context.
Yeah, I've always had a historical question about how the relational position would be born again with the whole argument, because we physicists heard about it first from John Stachel and then Julian Barber in the early 80s. Did they get it from Ehrman and so forth, or was it a simultaneous rediscovery?
So I think that at roughly, Stachel was the first person to talk about it in print, I think, among the people that I've read. But more or less, John Norton and Ehrman and Gleemore and others were reading these same writings of Einstein where you can find the Loch Betrachtung and wondering, oh, wow, what does that mean? What kind of argument is this and what's going on? And trying to figure that out. On the historical side, Stachel and Norton gave interpretations of it. Then Ehrman and Norton came up with a philosophical, very slight variant of Einstein's argument, pushed it into the philosophy arena and said, this is an argument against substratalism. But I don't think it was a good argument, so we're not going to talk about that. And again, it's relationalist, or it helps relationism only by opposing a substantial conception. So that, again, it doesn't do anything to promote relationism in a positive thesis sense. And the dynamical approach, again, it's another form of relationism. It's really another form of denial. The idea, here's one expression of it. We're going to see several expressions. Features of space-time should be understood to be fundamentally features of the dynamical laws and not features of a thing that's out there. So, for example, the inertial or affine structure in classical space-time is what it is because of what Newton's laws entail about the motion of bodies, material things behaving more generally. Or in special relativity, it's only right to say that space-time has Minkowski structure because the dynamical laws are Lorentz covariant, but not as an assertion about this thing that we live in called Minkowski space-time. So absolute space or space-time structure is not independently existing and prior to the laws, and nor does it act on bodies or sort of explain their motions in any ways for the dynamic people. Okay, so we'll see more how this is supported by their ideas. Now, Brown himself likes to talk about inertial motion and a kind of what he takes to be a mystery, which you consider, you get a feel for the mystery if you just consider this a kind of a Newtonian world that's very sparsely populated with just a few particles, okay? And so we've just got a few widely scattered non-interacting particles. The law of inertia, Newton's first law, tells us that there's a family of coordinate systems that we can lay down on space and time such that the space-time paths of each of these particles is a straight line in that coordinate system with constant velocity. How is that not a miraculous pre-established harmony? How do the particles know how to move in just the right way? Okay. Does that seem at least like an interesting puzzle or a mystery? Imagine all these particles very, very far away from each other, acting in this coordinated fashion. Now, Brown rejects any causal appeal to space as the thing they're in. And what kind of story is he rejecting? A philosopher named Graham Nerlich and others would tend to say, well, why do these isolated particles move in straight lines? Well, that's they somehow sort of feel that that's what straight lines are and the space they're embedded in. And the first law says, move along those things. Okay. The idea that the space-time connection plays this explanatory role in the special theory, Newtonian physics or whatever, that affine geodesics form ruts or grooves in space-time which somehow guide the free particles along their way has become very popular, at least in 20th century philosophical literature. Okay. So Nerlich said, Without the affine structure, there's nothing to determine how the free particle trajectory should lie. It has no antennae to tell it where the other objects are, even if there were other objects. It's because space-time has a certain shape that world lines lie the way they do, says Nerlich. And Brown thinks that's exactly wrong. It's one of the aims of his book to rebut this and related ideas. And Brown says, look, there is a mystery here. The objects, these bodies have no antennae, so how do they know the right way to move? But they also don't have little space-time curb feelers to detect the ruts and grooves. So there's a mystery on the other side, too. So it's for Brown, it's a spurious kind of explanation that Nerlich is offering. So the dynamical approach instead wants to not use space-time structures, whether Galilean or Minkowski space-time, as part of an explanation story, and instead offer a reductive account of, say, Minkowski space-time or the interval in terms of the dynamical symmetries of the laws governing matter. So, as I was saying, it's a type of relationship. And here, now we're going to talk about length contraction. And this is one of the key examples that gets discussed here. Consider, for example, the relativistic phenomenon of length contraction. Do rods behave as they do in virtue of the spatiotemporal environment in which they're immersed? Or are facts about the geometrical structure of Minkowski spacetime reducible to, among other things, just the behaviors of rods and clocks and things?
Maybe you can clarify something. It seems confusing to be discussing relationalism versus substantivalism with the example of Minkowski space or Newtonian physics. Because my understanding is that a relationalist would say that those are not good models of space-time. A good relational model of space-time is one like general relativity, where the space-time geometry is dynamical and in some sense satisfies Planck's principle the way it's intertwined with matter.
So, I'm in agreement with you, but there's this funny thing in the philosophy literature that some philosophers convince themselves that you can take a theory like Newtonian mechanics and work on it a bit and say, okay, here's a relational interpretation of this theory with no space-time, and then, of course, there's the standard traditional substantivalist interpretation. So. Maybe we should come back to that. I kind of agree with you in the writings, but that's the perspective that Brown... And I think this is why Brown doesn't emphasize that he's kind of a relationist, or at least maybe we should just say he's an anti-substantivalist, and that's it. Okay, I won't talk about length contraction, because everybody here knows it. Again, length contraction. Oliver Pooley says, do rods behave as they do in virtue of the spatiotemporal environment, or, this is the same quote. So that if one opts for the dynamical approach point of view, what explanation is to be given of why measuring rods in motion are contracted relative to similarly constituted rods at rest? And here's another element of their story. Brown reads Bell, that's John Bell, in an article called How to Teach Special Relativity, as seeking to demonstrate that a moving rod contracts and a moving clock dilates because of how it's made up and not because of the spatiotemporal environment. Now this is, how many of you have heard of Bell's paper, How to Teach Special Relativity? He advocates something he calls a Lorentzian pedagogy, which is instead of getting to the correct formula for length contraction and stuff like that, the cheap and easy way, using the principle of relativity and shifting reference frame and stuff. Let's build up a toy model of a measuring rod with atoms held together by electromagnetic forces and put that in motion in the reference frame that we're in and see how the shape of the magnetic forces changes and all that stuff. Bell, I think, is just saying that's pedagogically useful for some reason. Brown, however, and Pooley, at some points, they seem to take that as that story as somehow a better explanation of length contraction. And then there's the problem with Windows. So, on one level, there's nothing wrong with the Lorentz pedagogy. It's just its special merit is to drive home the lesson that the laws of physics in any one reference frame account for all physical phenomena, including the observations of moving observers. If you want to do it, you can stick in one reference frame the whole time. Okay. On the other hand, listen to this, by contrast. The dynamical approach is an alternative viewpoint according to which the explanation of length contraction is ultimately to be sought in terms of the dynamics of the microstructure of the contracting rod. Which sounds more like, actually, you don't really have a good explanation if you just derive it the cheap and easy way. According to the DA, every relativistic phenomenon has an explanation with no direct appeal to geometry. Dynamics suffice. Why do the twins age differently? Not because they literally measure the interval along their respective world lines, but because the laws governing the relevant biological processes in each dictate that on meeting they will be asynchronous. You're seeing?
I just don't understand the Harvey, the kind of, whatever you call it, dynamical. I don't understand what it means. All these derivations that they're pointing to are still done in the context of a space-time or a space. Maybe it's not a Minkowski space-time. But they're still talking about motion through space. They're still using Maxwell's equations and so on. So what does it really mean? I thought the idea was to get rid of space and just talk about some other relations. But what are these relations?
So,
distances between things?
Right. So
what's in the place?
Good question. And you're again, anticipating something I'll be saying in a minute. But I guess the idea is to think of, say, the structure of Minkowski spacetime, the geometry that Minkowski brought up forward, as not representing directly a thing, but as codifying features of the way things will behave because the laws are Lorentz covariant. Because now, does that make sense? Does that really get rid of space-time, is your question? I don't think it does either, but okay. We'll see. Maybe you can say it even more forcefully than me.
But they have no proposal what to put in place of space-time, if I understand.
I think that the proposal is just have a different attitude about this. But
okay.
Here's the barest expression of this dynamical approach. Space-time has Minkowski structure because the laws of nature all have Lorentz covariance as their symmetry group. And that's it's a kind of an explanatory claim. What is the explanatory cart and what's the horse? They say that the horse that's pulling the cart is the laws of physics. Because they have this Lorentz covariant structure, that's why it's right to say Minkowski geometry is where we live. You compare this with the reverse. The laws of nature all have the Lorentz covariance as their symmetry group because space-time has Minkowski structure. And there are some philosophers who like this other way of putting the cart and the horse in order, okay? Thinking that why, if you want to explain, why do all these laws share the same symmetry group? Well, a good explanation is, well, the world, the space-time in which everything unfolds has that structure, so they darn well have to. And the question we're looking at today is one of these perspectives obviously right and the other wrong.
Excuse me, may I ask you, because I'm a big puzzle. I mean, what is the meaning of the statement that space-time has Minkowski structure? What does it mean? I mean, which sense? In operational sense that you can actually observe the structure or what?
So I think that
how can I convince myself that that space-time has Minkowski structure or whatever structure?
Yeah. Well, so different philosophers will answer this different ways, actually. So Brown's answer would be the operational one you just kind of hinted at. I have these stable things that I can use as measuring rods. I have light signals that have certain nice properties, and and clocks and so forth, and just very natural ways of mapping out distance and time structure using these objects reveals that Minkowski geometry. What's a different possible story? What it could mean is, something like what philosophers call inference to the best explanation. Let's set aside general relativity. So all we have are 20th century special relativistic theories. The idea is we have all these different theories, and in order to make sense of their mathematics and their symmetries and everything, the best way of understanding why the laws of nature are this way is that the universe has an absolute spatiotemporal structure, and the laws fit with that structure.
Can I try a version of this? Mm-hmm. Which I think is the version in Einstein's 1905 paper. You start with principles, which are the principle of the relativity of inertial frame, which is an operationally checkable principle. You include in that the principle of the invariance of the speed of light. You then construct, and I'm using the word construct in a strong sense, a description of distant events and distant processes by using light signals to determine information at those events. Mm-hmm. By those two principles, the geometry that you construct to describe the physics of different events will be Minkowski spacetime by construction. So there's no spacetime as some physically existing entity apart from the construction that is given to it. Foundation is that principle of the relativity of inertial frame and the invariance of the velocity of light.
So those are perfectly good foundations for deriving that geometric structure. And what you didn't do was sort of give what philosophers hanker for, which is a kind of an tell something with a word explanation in it. So what explains this very, what was initially an amazingly puzzling phenomenon that everybody measures the speed of light to be the same?
This is but from this, nothing explains it. I see the point, but nothing explains it. It is a principle gotten from nature, from observation. And the emphasis from this point of view is that space-time is not some pre-existing thing. And here I agree with, I think, the way that you put it. Space-time doesn't exist because of physical interactions and elementary particles and the force and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think Einstein would say that the success of this reasoning in correctly predicting the results of many experiments justifies the premises, but it doesn't explain the premises.
Okay. Insofar as I can map what you said onto the kind of opposition framework that I'm working with here, you sound now like you're more on Harvey's side. But let's see if that goes on. Here's a question that philosophers have tackled, but there's no consensus, I think. Is it possible for there to be a bunch of different laws of nature with different kinds of symmetries that don't line up with each other? Is that sort of conceptually possible for a reasonable physics for a world?
You mean incompatible with each other?
Well, different, yes.
Well, we do have that, right? I mean, different strong interactions have one set of symmetries. Weak interactions have another set of some different gauge groups. One has
space-time symmetry.
One has a parity violation.
Space-time.
Space-time symmetries.
Yeah, that's a space-time symmetry.
Parity.
Reflection symmetry.
Yeah.
One has it, one doesn't have it.
I think the idea with that question, though, is more about, you know, some laws that are Galilean invariant and some that are Lorentz covariant and maybe some that are Aristotelian, that kind of bizarre bag. But maybe the answer is simply, sure, why not? Put together a physics and you can do it. All right. Here, I want to give a couple of objections to the dynamical approach as I've sketched it. And the first one is going to be controversial, I think. They support their view by insisting that Lorentz contraction of rods and time dilation are real physical effects, and it's because they are real physical effects that space-time has this structure. It's the behavior, and this is mixed up though with the Lorentz pedagogy that I mentioned. And I want to object to that I think it's possible to maintain, maybe right, although maybe I'll get talked out of that, but I think it's possible to maintain this other perspective on which length contraction and time dilation are not real effects, but are a matter of perspective, sort of like looking at a disk. You turn it on its to an angle, it looks like an oval. And so is using quantum theory like Bell did in one reference frame to derive Lorentz contraction, is that uncovering the real explanation or just doing a nice mathematical consistency check?
So can I just argue against the perspectival approach? I mean, if you have a twin who goes away and comes back and he's younger than the other one, then this is real effect. It's not perspective. You can look at him from another angle and say he's younger.
No, that's true. But but when I just have two clocks crossing like this with observers with them and they each see the other's clock is running slow, is that a real effect or is that perspectival? Does in order to understand what's going on, does the one twin looking at the other twin's clock just doing this have to sort of get down and dirty into the quantum mechanics of the clock mechanism or the biological processes in their bodies or not? That's
so one point of confusion is that so it was Brown's argument for the dynamical approach that one can describe things like Lorentz contraction in terms of microstates, because it seems from the way you presented it that wasn't an argument for the dynamical approach, but rather an example of the dynamical approach being pursued by a physicist in the literature.
I think that's right. Yeah. I don't think it's a linchpin of the argument for the dynamical approach. Yeah. Maybe it's just something that he said and I reacted to it, and I want to try to see if I can push the opposite. Now, Oliver Cooley says this, the substantivalist should agree, so even his opponent or Brown's opponent should agree, that a complex material rod does not conform to the axioms of some geometry simply because that is the substantival geometry in which it's immersed. The rod would not do what it does were the laws governing its microphysical parts different. Key respects. There's two ways of reading this idea of conforming to the geometry. And on one reading, I think Pooley's straightforwardly right. On the other, he's straightforwardly wrong. So here's my question. If you take the substantivalist's viewpoint for a second, Minkowski space-time is this thing in which we're immersed. Can you just take a physical system, insert it into that world with Minkowski spacetime, and can it somehow fail to conform to the geometry? Well, no. In the sense that the real interval between any two points, spacetime points, about that object is going to follow all the ratios of the intervals and so forth. It's all going to obey Minkowski geometry. What that system might not do is manifest that Minkowski geometry in a very straightforward way. If it's got funny laws governing its behavior. Okay. Again, I'm not going to argue that my counter considerations are decisive. I'm trying to just throw up some opposition to the dynamical approach and maybe get discussion going. But there is a tension I want to point out between some of the things that Brown and Cooley say in one place and another. And it has to do with this Lorentz pedagogy. At a different place in a key paper that they wrote together, they acknowledge this. It's the fact that the laws are Lorentz covariant that explains why bodies Lorentz contract. To appeal to any further details of the laws that govern the cohesion of these bodies would be a mistake. But that's straightforwardly in tension with the things that we read earlier about how to understand length and traction, really, you need to know about the intermolecular forces holding the rod together and see what happens when it's in motion. So there is a tension in their own works about that. Let me see if I can go back and find. Here's the thing that's in tension with. The explanation of length contraction is ultimately to be sought in terms of the dynamics of the microstructure of the contracting rod. So I think there's a tension there. And in fact, I think Oliver kind of has shifted his perspective.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you think that is the tension possibly a result of the ambiguity in the term explanations? One thing I've nearly never understood about this literature is what explains is actually supposed to, how it's being used. And it looks like it might be used differently in these two circumstances.
Maybe, I don't know. the way the word explains functions in the literature, I think, is that for philosophers, whether we embrace it openly or not, inference to the best explanation is how we do trying to understand the ontology of the world.
That you're using the word explanation. I mean, the first instance, maybe we can take this up in the questions, but the first instance looks like the ontology, the first book that you put up.
Okay.
A explains B is saying that A is, A and B are two ways of expressing the same thing. I mean, in other words, you could replace explains with the same, these are two different descriptions of the situation.
In the first quote?
Yeah.
Let's come back to that.
Good.
Can I ask a question about that? I haven't quite understood the tension. So it seems to me you might be saying that the tension between them saying that the details of the laws that govern cohesion are not relevant and what they said earlier, but it seems to me reading that quote that what there's, I'm not saying the details of the laws that govern cohesion are not relevant. They're saying it's the Lorentz covariance of those laws that's relevant, and other details excluding their Lorentz covariance are not relevant to questions about length contraction.
Well, the further details would include the whole story that gives you the shape of the molecular bonds and so forth. So it's I take it to be exactly the kind of stuff that they said, you know, in bringing up this Lorentz pedagogy gives you a deeper understanding of length contraction as a real phenomenon. Is what they're now saying here. Well, you don't really need to know that.
I think they're just saying you don't need to know anything about those laws except that they have Lorentz covariance. Mm-hmm. So the laws are relevant, and so that's consistent with their earlier claim, but they're saying other features of the laws are not relevant. It's Lorentz covariance that's key.
That they're definitely saying. But then it's the question of what are they saying when they kind of put this Lorentz pedagogy story on a pedestal? What is the point of doing what Bell did? He said maybe it's a good way of teaching young physicists special relativity. I have my doubts about that, but at least it would be a very good mathematical exercise. But that maybe, if this quote is right, that's all it could ever be, is a mathematical exercise. Can you do the math in the right way to get the result you know has to happen to pop out of a realistic treatment of a rod?
So one of the things that had motivated Bell to develop this Lorentzian pedagogy a bit in that paper was his rocket ship.
That's where I'm going next.
Okay. Yeah. I was just curious what story you would give in the perspectival frame of why the rope breaks then.
Right. Good. So let's go there. But for me, the Lorentz pedagogy is a bit like creating a 10 to the 23rd atom quantum model of a square peg and another one of a round hole to try to show why the one won't fit into the other, when actually a very simple geometric point and saying, by the way, they're solid, is the most enlightening explanation for why that's not going to work. All right. I'll come back to the... Should I do? Yeah, I'll just go ahead and do the rockets and the string right now. Come back to this. So Bell uses this example in his paper of two rockets that are connected by a string and not a very strong string, and they start accelerating at the same moment in our initial rest frame so that they maintain the same separation in that frame as they go up to speed. And this has been used by not just Bell, but Brown and many other philosophers lately to say, see, no, Lorentz contraction is a really real phenomenon. It's not perspectival. And I want to resist that. So here's the story, right? I cribbed this picture from Tim Maudlin's new introductory book on space and time. Here's the rockets. They start accelerating at this moment, but they maintain their distance. And because the string is getting faster and the motion is getting faster and faster, it's Lorentz contracting. It can't bridge that gap anymore between the spaceships. What was striking is you know, Bell saying that when he gave this example to a bunch of physicists at CERN, his colleagues, the consensus was the string won't break. Okay, now, everybody's heard this story now. Everybody knows the string has to break. But why did they think the string wouldn't break? Well, because they must have been thinking along these lines. If the Lorentz Fitzgerald contraction is merely a matter of looking at the same events from a different angle, or merely a matter of describing the same events in a different coordinate system, then of course it can't cause the thread to break. If it really has nothing to do with electrical or interatomic forces, then it can't have any observable physical effects. And indeed, what we've called the coordinate-based Lorentz Fitzgerald contraction is nothing more than an observation about the relations between different Lorentz coordinate systems. But as Bell rightly insists, there's also a physical Lorentz Fitzgerald contraction that does depend on the interatomic forces and can have physical effects. Sorry, I didn't mention this. This is Tim Maudlin, otherwise the most fierce opponent of the dynamical approach out there. But to my mind, he's drunk this Kool-Aid that Bell is selling of the string showing that it's not a perspectival effect, but somehow something real. So why does the string break? Here's what I want to say. It's not because, as even Maudlin seems to make this kind of story, it's not because some special physical effect springs up in the string, because it is in motion. Now notice, forget about the acceleration part, right? The claim is just that the Lorentz contraction is a phenomenon of just relative velocity. That's what we're talking about. Of course, all sorts of things happen in the string because of acceleration. Shock waves and various things happening now. We're setting that aside. The dynamic approach people are trying to say, just be looking at a string that's moving at a fast velocity with respect to you, and that contraction is all this interesting dynamical stuff going on in the atoms. Well, I don't think so. I don't think there's this mysterious physical effect that springs up. I think it's because the accelerations of the rockets cause their separation to become greater than what the string's elasticity permits it to bridge. And Maudlin would agree with that. This is a story that you can narrate from various different reference frames perspectives. Bell chooses the perspective of the reference frame where they started at rest. And then you have this strong intuition that, oh, well, of course the separation between the rockets has not increased. In some sense, the separation has increased. When you look at space-time points that correspond to the natural simultaneous points in the frame of the string that's moving. And you can narrate it from a different reference frame moving in the opposite direction if you want. But what I want to say is, in none of these stories, narrate it in whatever reference frame you want, in none of these stories do the details of the interatomic forces matter in the way that dynamical approach people say it does.
I'm not following how you would narrate the story in that original rest frame. Because, like, sure, you can jump into any of the momentarily co-moving inertial frames with either of the rockets, and then because of relativity of simultaneity, see that they're actually moving further and further apart, and the proper distance is increasing. But, like, I mean, as I understood it, Bell's point was that because any of these reference frames is just as good as the other, we ought to be able to give an account for it in that inertial rest frame where they do definitely stay the same distance apart. So what is the narration of this story that doesn't appeal to length, the actual contraction of the rope in that particular frame?
Well, this perspectivalism, I don't take it to involve denial that it's a real phenomenon that from the perspective of a certain frame, the string looks shorter, right? And so from the perspective of that frame, at a moment in time, the string would have to have one end here and one end there, and because of the length it appears to have now, it can't do that anymore. So I'm not trying to deny that there's length contraction has to be part of the story in this reference frame. But what I'm trying to say is that it's the exact same length contraction that is what Tim Maudlin called, a matter of looking at the same events from a different angle or describing the same events in a different coordinate system. I don't think there's a special physical version of Lorentz contraction on top of this perspectivalism.
It almost seems like, you know, it's the old adage that one philosopher is modus ponens, another is modus tollens, that, like, I think any philosopher would agree with this, but that someone agreeing with Brown would then take that and say, okay, so clearly there's a realistic interpretation of length contraction in this frame and in the rocket experiment, so therefore we should give it a realistic interpretation in all these other cases where we don't necessarily have something breaking or something like that happening. Where it seems like you're just kind of going the other way around and saying, well, yes, it seems realistic here, but because we don't need to, we can look at it perspectively elsewhere, we should look at the same here as well.
That's probably fair. Yeah. So how many people here have heard this story before and are of the view that that Bell's example demonstrates that length contraction is real, whatever real means? Don't be a Okay. I said that was going to be a polemical part of this paper. All right, let's go back, though, to my second objection. And this, I think, is basically what Raphael said a while ago. I don't understand the dynamical approach's claim that you don't need space-time structure. It's sort of follows conceptually from the laws, because it seems to me that actually the very statements of the laws presuppose the space-time structure for their meaningfulness. So think about Newton's law of gravity in the very simplest undergraduate form, m1, m2, g over r squared. Now that looks like you could do that without Newton's substantival space, because classical relationist is willing to say, well, yeah, every two particles have a relation of distance to each other. That's okay, that much spatiality there is in the world. And that's what Newton's law appeals to, the law of gravity. But the second law, or the first law for that matter, says something quite different. It says this kind of thing. And this dt here, and the d squared x, if we do put it in that form, that is spatiotemporal structure. So I don't know how to understand F equals ma, except set against a background of structure that gives those mathematical expressions sense. So that's the challenge. In order to be stated, classical laws presuppose a meaningful prior space-time structure. And that's true in special relativity, even if you go to a coordinate-free notation. It's not about x's and t's. It's just the spatiotemporal structure that makes these derivative type operators meaningful.
More precisely, because some laws require the metric and some laws don't. For example, Gauss's law does not delta V equals zero does not require the space-time have a metric. But F equals ma requires a metric because F is the grade of the potential, and you have to raise that index and set that one form to be related to a vector, which is acceleration.
Okay.
So there is a metric there.
So the first one, would it require, though, at least the affine structure?
Mm-hmm. Yes, as well.
Yeah.
No.
No?
Because the electric field is actually a vector density, and its gradient is defined as that.
Okay. I'm happy.
It does need the differential structure.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Right. Not the affines.
Okay. The differential, well, the topological structure.
Yeah, the topological thing.
Right.
Sort of a souped up topological structure.
Okay.
But the point stands, many of the laws require that the space-time have a mention.
Right. The standard law. And some ways of writing it down, you'll see it right in there. You stick the Minkowski metric as if it were a G in some of these expressions. Okay. Now, what all of this talk and the dynamical approach raises is a question. What do you guys mean by a law of nature? How do you think of the laws such that they can play this explanatory foundation role that you want to assign to them? And I just raised that. I've raised it with Harvey. And he has his own way of answering. He's an empiricist about laws. He thinks they're just regularities in the way things behave in nature. But we'll see. We can talk about that later. All right, we did the string.
So a question about the previous slide.
Yeah.
What happens when physics changes, essentially? So is the substantive argument, does it also propose sort of the converse, that any physical attempt to describe the world in terms of laws that don't presuppose a space-time won't be viable? I mean, for example, because there are research programs that focus on that sort of attitude, the amplitude, and that sort of thing.
No, I don't think so at all.
So even if physics was able to be stated without any space-time in any of the laws, that would be irrelevant to this argument.
No. What I mean is, so for the purpose of today's story, I'm opposing the dynamical approach. I say you can't spell out the content, at least of classical physics laws, without, like in special relativity, special relativistic theories, without presupposing background space-time structure. I'm not saying you can't do it in some post-general relativity. In fact, I think that'd be great. Because my sympathies actually lie with relationism, like Harvey's. I think you can't get it on the cheap by just saying, it's just a feature of the laws. Now let's turn to general relativity for the last few minutes. And here's the $64,000 question. Does the metric represent the structure of a substantial entity, space-time, or rather a physical field in space-time? That question came out right at the beginning. Harvey says it's a physical field in space-time. I think a number of other physicists agree with this view. Well, that brings you some automatic good stuff if you say that. Dynamics determine space-time structure is clearly true in general relativity then. It's kind of an automatic victory for relationalism because, well, what's left of space-time is just the manifold. It doesn't have all that absolute structure. Harvey likes to emphasize that in general relativity we get the first non-miraculous and non-substantivalist explanation of that mystery that we talked about. Well, how do the particles know to follow these kind of trajectories in space-time? So he says, for the first time since Aristotle introduced the fundamental distinction between natural and forced motion, inertial motion is part of the dynamics. It's no longer a miracle or something that has to have a special separate postulate. And Harvey takes that to be a good reason for thinking of the metric as just as another bit of the dynamics, a physical field. But I think, despite these nice things, I don't think we can actually maintain that the metric field should be thought of as a physical field, sort of like electromagnetic tensors. So let's just go to my reasons why not. Well, no. What else Harvey says, here's the way he develops his dynamical approach in general relativity. He says, the metric can be viewed as encoding a structure of space-time, but only because the dynamical laws respect the strong equivalence principle, and that's sort of very analogous, he thinks, to Minkowski's space-time structure is what we've got because all the laws are specially are Lorentz covariant. And he cites this tensor vector scalar theory to support his idea that the metric doesn't automatically or by definition have geometric significance. Instead, it has to, as it were, earn that status. Now, in the tensor vector scalar theory, there's two different G fields. The first one plays the normal role in the mathematics, raising and lowering indices and so forth. But the second is supposed to be the physical metric, which you would see revealed by the behaviors of rods and clocks and stuff like that in this theory. All right. I don't think you can say that the metric is just another physical field. Why? It's very, very different than other kinds of physical fields. It can't go to zero over an extended region in any coordinate system, which most fields in some models or other can do. I don't think it can carry genuine energy momentum, although that's a much more controversial statement, so let's not attack me on that one. But even if it did, even if you do say, oh yeah, the metric field can carry energy momentum, I totally buy that. That doesn't mean it's not that it doesn't represent substantival spacetime. It just means that substantival spacetime itself might have energy content. And finally, this is the most important consideration. It's the metric that's responsible for making the manifold into a space-time in any meaningful sense. It's the thing that separates out the time-like directions from the other three directions in the manifold. If you just take away the metric, as Einstein famously said, and what you're left with is nothing, or at least not a space-time. So it can't be thought of as just another field in space-time. Now, the metric, as it's used in general relativity, gives mathematical meaning to things like covariant derivatives and gradients and all that kind of stuff. And I would say, hence, it is a priori the metric of space-time. If we call that into question, then we don't really know what this means anymore. We don't know what is this Einstein tensor representing if the metric isn't playing its geometrical role. That said, we have to keep distinct the metric as a bit of mathematics that we write down on paper and put in our theory versus whatever it represents in physical reality. And my view would be in general relativity, since we can't get Mach's principle to work out, we can't really maintain that the metric is totally determined by the material contents of the world, what this represents is space-time structure. It's mutable, it's dynamic, unlike Minkowski, but it's the same sort of thing. So that's the answer to that question that you said at the beginning, Lee. I think you have to say the metric is representing real space-time structure in a theory like GR, and it's not not to be thought of as just another physical field. It's it's a second rank tensor and it's dynamic, and that's where the analogy really ends.
So, I mean, it's the metric fluctuation that can go to zero, right?
Pardon?
It's really the metric fluctuation that we think we are trying to quantize when, say, we are trying to quantize.
Sort of the deviation from the Minkowski.
And that can go to zero easily, so. I mean,
no, that's
it's
right.
It's kind of built into the mathematical structure that G mu near will never go to zero, or there's a limit where it's kind of in the flat space time limit it won't go to zero. Right? So.
Yeah, but the bit of the metric that's fluctuating is not a tensor, so it doesn't have the kind of invariance to be thought of as like other tensor fields.
I think I disagree. Maybe this is a discussion we can have. I disagree on both grounds. metric physically can go to zero in extended regions, and it is the thing that we want to quantize. The fluctuations are only defined in linearized theory.
Right.
We know by now that the quantization of the linearized theory doesn't bring us much wisdom about the quantization of the whole theory.
Yeah.
Except for the argument about what can go to zero, it seems like most of the statements on your previous slide could also apply to any other physical field. I mean, you could similarly say, if you're writing a covariant derivative, then it needs to include whatever the thing's coupling is to the electromagnetic field, which could be zero or could be non-zero. So I don't really see space-time as more fundamental than other physical fields, which seems like what you would need to have a substantivist viewpoint, if I'm understanding you correct.
Well, so I think there's at least two considerations. One is the can't go to zero one, but the other is it's unlike any other physical field because you take it away and you don't have space-time anymore.
But you take away another physical field and you don't have gauge structure anymore. You don't have that particular gauge group.
Well, I'm talking about just classical general relativity, and you know, we could take away a scalar matter field, we could take away the electromagnetic field and just set that zero everywhere. We still got a space-time structure.
But I'm speaking classically too. You still have the U1 of electromagnetism that goes away if you take away that field.
May I try something with
sure.
this? I thought with your interest in causation, you would use a stronger argument based on causation. That is, what the laws are about really is what causes what. It's a description of what causes the thing. That's a very naive, I'm sure you have more sophisticated ways to say it, but in some sense, we're doing physics because causation is real. We want to understand its features.
Mm-hmm.
And the metric of space-time is a summary of information about the causal structure and the history of the universe. And that's a role that no other physical field plays. And without causation, there would be nothing.
I may be more of a causation skeptic than you expect me to be. But I'm happy for the aid and comfort. That's an argument that can be made, yeah, for the special role of the metric also. Yeah, causal structure. OK, we're almost done. And so Oliver Pooley himself diverges from Harvey because Pooley, when it comes to general relativity, thinks it's a perfectly substantival theory. So it can be true to say dynamical laws determine space-time structure, but still substantivalism be victorious. Just about that tensor vector scalar thing, I would just want to point out, even if it's conceptually coherent and a nice alternative theory, it's still a different theory from general relativity, and so I don't think we have to make inferences from what role the metrics play in that theory to what their status is, either as encoding geometry or not, in GR itself. Okay, so the dynamical approach I've been trying to argue, as it's cashed out in Harvey Brown's slogans and some specific claims, is open to some objections. In the simplest bare form, I don't think that this is not obviously more credible or interesting than the substantivalist contrary, which would say the substantival space-time structure explains why the dynamical laws are the way they are. Okay, well, we've been going quite a while, and I could say how the dynamical approach as a species of relationalism needs to be fleshed out more. Well, I think if you want to defend it, what Harvey really should do is get more explicit and say what he means by the laws of nature and how they are to be understood and how some of them can be written down or understood as not presupposing space-time structure, except general relativity, which obviously that's the right thing about the background independence of general relativity. You can write those things down without presupposing a background structure, but earlier theories are not like that. Okay, so let me stop there.
So we've had a lot of questions, but we have time for a couple more, I think. Maybe I can start, though. Here's an argument that I kind of expected you to make, but you didn't make, which is, so he says that the this explains the miracle of inertial motion. But on the other hand, he's saying that the reason it works is because all the different, you know, forces and whatever have the same symmetry. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me you're trading one miracle for maybe another one.
Yeah, that's a good point. He actually, Brown considers it in his book, and he says, well, explanation has to stop somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, also, I'm sort of like, that was, I think it was John Norton, that was one of his arguments he came up with against it. But I mean, I think you can also point out that, I mean, ideally, as you know, based on the work that people are doing here and elsewhere, I mean, we're not going to wind up with just sort of all these disparate laws that sort of exist independently. Ideally, we'd like to have more of a unified framework in which really there's only sort of one set of physical laws that have one set of symmetries, and what we call electromagnetism or electroweak or the strong force just split off in different regimes. So in that case, it's not really this grand coincidence.
That was in your paper.
Yeah.
Wait.
I'm trying to figure out whether you and I disagree or agree about space-time. And let me put forward a version of the dynamical approach, which I think is defensible, and what I think that Harvey and all of the other people should be saying, even though it doesn't fit with everything they do say. And I think it's, well, let's go back to the example of electromagnetism and special relativity. So classical electromagnetism was originally formulated as if there's an absolute distinction between rest and motion, and as if there's absolute simultaneity. Along comes Einstein, and on basis of principles about the way things behave according to classical electromagnetism, constructs this structure that we now recognize as Minkowski structure, and shows that, you know what? Classical electromagnetism doesn't, in fact, make use of any notion of absolute rest or distance simultaneity. And then I say, okay, then, and if that's true of all the laws of nature, then there just is nothing in physical reality. It just makes no sense to talk about a distinction between rest and motion that the laws of physics make no use of. And on that view, talk about space-time structure and to talk about certain symmetries of the laws of nature are just two ways of talking about the same thing. And I think of that as neither a substantivalist nor a relationist view. It's an absolutist view in the sense that you think of the laws of nature as absolute and the symmetries they have as facts about the world. On that view, you shouldn't ask, do the laws of nature explain space-time structure or vice versa? Because, you know, if they're both two ways of talking about the same thing, it makes no sense of one sense to talk about one explaining the other. Right? So that's where I would say, you know, things that, you know, I would say the things that Pauli and Harvey say don't really fit in with this kind of view. So
okay, and then how do you? I mean,
yeah.
In classical special relativity, how do you talk about the laws and their mathematical content without, you know, and say it's not that they presuppose a pre-existing structure.
Right.
How am I supposed to think about those laws?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, the derivative stuff in it, which seems to presuppose.
So the space-time structure is precisely the stuff you need to presuppose in order to in order to state the laws. And because we don't need absolute rest, that's not part of the state the law. Because so yes, we need the differential structure. But that's a fact about the laws.
I think that is really close to what has become called in the literature sophisticated substantivalism.
So there's this theorem by Quine that if you have a group of transformations that are allowed and a group of symmetries that you want to be respected, that's a subgroup of the big group, then this just automatically comes with a space, that's a structure of space. So like, which side of the debate do you think that supports?
So I think that theorem must be using a space in the phrase, it comes with a space, and maybe in a different sense than the philosophers talking in these.
A classical example is the Minkowski space is associated with Poincaré.
I would imagine the theorem is a kind of an existence claim, right? It's proving that whenever certain conditions are met, there exists a mathematical structure with such and such properties then? Is that right?
I think it's more of an if and only if.
Okay.
Maybe Lie groups, I guess.
Yeah.
So there's already differentiable structure metrics in it, all sorts of stuff. That's what it is. You can have discrete groups, though.
Yeah, you can have discrete groups.
I'm not sure.
So to me, I would interpret that as all kind of being a discussion at the level of mathematics. And then, I mean, what the problem that the philosophers like to try to tackle is looking at bits of mathematics that are obviously parts of successful physical theories. Which parts do we have to take to refer to something out there, as opposed to something that's just part of our notation, just part of our manipulations, and so forth?
Are you talking about, I think sometimes it was called the Erlangen program or something like that, which said that one should think of a space in terms of its automorphisms or in terms
that's
of
what,
its
that's what I'm
image,
about.
One should put the automorphisms first.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
That's all I can say.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear philosophers talking about symmetry as irrelevant for this issue, because my understanding is that relationalism has its roots in Leibniz's principles, particularly the principle of the identity being discernible, which taken literally means that there are no symmetries. And general relativity is a good example of that. General relativity, generically, has a theory on infinite dimensional space of geometries, has no symmetries. In fact, it's a theorem, there are no killing fields on the configuration of the phase space of general relativity. There are special classes of solutions of many zero which have symmetries on those solutions, but they're of measure zero and they shouldn't be, it seems to me, of any interpretation of that or interest. So the challenge of relationalism is to give physical interpretation to a domain in which there are no symmetries, and that's part of getting rid of absolute structures, getting rid of symmetry. There are gauge symmetries. The gauge symmetries are another way in which you get rid of absolute structure by saying that the space of degrees of freedom is not the metric on the manifold, but the equivalence class of metrics mounted to homomorphism.
I follow parts of that.
I could cash it out.
Yeah, but I want to go back to what I said. Actually, I confessed earlier. I don't think. I mean, I'm attracted to a relationist perspective in the Leibnizian original mode, which passes through Locke and Einstein to some extent. It looks like it's got something of support in general relativity, and so for me. There's no being a relationist about Minkowski spacetime, or Newtonian physics in any way. For me, the interesting thing these are interesting mental exercises, and I think it's not bad to think about these kind of philosophical questions. But the real action for deciding what spacetime really is like in our world comes in the future when we have a successful quantum gravity theory. That's the way I see things. I think, and the fact that several approaches to quantum gravity are kind of relationally inspired is a thing of hopefulness for me. I don't think you can read off of anything we've got in physics yet any very strong argument for one side or the other.
I'm confused by this. Contrast between relationalism and you call it substantivalism.
Yeah, or absolutism.
Well, absolute, I don't understand. So, substantive, I only heard the word once, or twice before, criticized and accused me of being a substantivalist. I had to go look up and see what it was. I had a sense that I was proud to be, you know, that I liked being accused of it. Mm-hmm. And that was right. But, I mean, relationalism is a much broader idea.
Yes.
It doesn't say whether space-time is has the same status of reality as electromagnetic field or quarks or anything. I don't understand why they're contrasted in this way. So, for example, why don't people say, why aren't we relationalists about electrons? We think that space-time is the only real thing and electrons are some sort of pseudo things. Or, I mean, you could pick on anything. You could make photons as real and electrons as unreal. You could do the opposites. Why, there's something special that people have picked on space-time. So, to my mind, all physics is relational. I don't know any theory of physics that's not in some sense relational, in the sense that it doesn't just talk about independent objects. The whole focus is on how they're connected to each other, whether it's absolute space or it's any
right.
other.
That's relational in a different sense than the relationism as this thread going through the history of debates about space-time, because the relationism in that latter sense is, as I said at the beginning, primarily the denial of absolute space or substantival space. Whenever it pops up, try to hit whack-a-mole.
Yeah,
but
why do you
down.
Equate absolute space with substantival space?
I mean,
relativity, we know space is not absolute.
Absolute,
but it's certainly substantival.
Well, I shouldn't. I should use the word substantival so that there's kind of a continuity once you get to general relativity, yeah. But we use the word absolute because Newton's absolute space started this whole fight in a very serious way. Many, many philosophers, not just Leibniz, thought it was abhorrent for various reasons, this infinite being, which was the sensorium of God and part of the world. Now Newton said, I don't think it's a substance, but it's closer to a substance than anything else. And that's kind of a good way of thinking of it. But
isn't that what you said in the beginning? Like maybe the dichotomy is there are people that think that space can exist without matter.
Right.
And the other, which says, well, no, there's no way I can talk about space, time, if there's no matter. And that's really the dichotomy. So in that sense, you are, you know, if you think, because you do believe that space exists without matter.
Of course, I don't think any real working physicist, qua working physicist, doubts the existence of the space-time metric. Now, we could have another discussion whether or not it could exist without matter or not.
But that's what is
we know that matter couldn't exist without space-time, but that seems to me a very different issue.
The metric as a phenomenological thing, in the same way that entropy and heat exist. Yes, but can one tell a reductive story on some other foundation that makes the metric field and general relativity turn out to be a sort of emerging from some other kind of structure? If so, then you don't have to think of it as part of the fundamental furniture of the world. It's that other stuff that it emerges from.
Well, but that can be the same for electrons. It can be the same for
absolutely.
And it probably is the same for all of us.
I think
so
that's
I don't see this.
That would be
I
okay.
think that the history has settled the question, and the substantivalists have won. Now, that doesn't mean it's the ultimate substance. All of these things could be emergent and probably are emergent. And
well,
some of us are working on theories in which they emerge from deeper things.
Right, but on one way of narrating the history of this debate through the centuries, then once we get to that next stage, then substantivalism is lost again.
In fact, Rafa, I'm surprised that you identify yourself that way, because the causal set picture is a picture precisely about how space-time is a classical, rough, coarse-grained description of a network of causal relations, which are fundamental.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely a relational picture.
That's what I was trying to say. It seems to me relationalism is endemic in
physics, because there are lots of people who don't believe in causal sets, but you do believe in causal sets.
Well, I wish I could claim that the only relational approach was causal sets, but I can't claim that. So I think there's a confusion of language or something.
The language
like
can...
That. I don't see any conflict at all between saying that space-time is real and that just like water is real or something.
Well, you know,
but that it's an effective description of something which could have a deeper description.
Look, at one level, even Leibniz would agree with you. Leibniz said space is a real, well-founded phenomenon. He says that in one of his... And what does he mean? He means there really is structure out there of distance relations, which is Euclidean, I mean, which is embeddable in Euclidean geometry. That's all he meant. So he says, it's not that, as Newton would say, space is this kind of thing and its points endure over time, much the way the electrons endure over time. But there is spatiotemporal structure, absolutely. Leibniz, but he wanted to pare that down to some sort of minimum, if he could.
I think that I would suggest that we just simply retire the word substantialism, because as you pointed out, there's a real sense in which Newton denied being a substantialist, and they say, okay, if Newton wasn't substantialist, then nobody was, because he says in De Grave, the points of space are only individuated by their by their relations to each other. So if I would take these two points and switch them, that would not be any change.
That's because he was a sophisticated substantialist.
But the phrase, but okay, it's a substance whose parts don't have any intrinsic properties except the relation that
it's a relational
to each
substance.
Other. is Raphael a substantivalist or not? Well, points in a causal set have no individuation except for they have relations to each other, right? They have that there's this causal structure, but that's all they have. Is that substantivalism or not? I think it's just kind of confusing to try and say is this substantivalism or it isn't.
If you believe that points exist independently of anything,
but they have no properties other than their
fine, but you think that they exist. So if you think that points exist, then I don't know, I cannot pronounce the name. But whether you think these points are points in a causal set or points of space time, or whatever, I think. That's
what I think we should. These are good points. But what I think we should retire from the debate is any insistence on the identity of the fundamental stuff, whether it be electrons or space points, as being somehow importantly related to whether they exist. Newton says if you took this point and swapped it with this other one, nothing would have changed.
Right.
And I say the same about this electron and the other one in your shirt.
Right. Yeah.
We're substantivalists about both.
Well, see, that's why that's why I think the terminology is misleading. I think a lot of people want to be relationist about the stuff the world's made of,
which is points on the point.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that everyone agrees, let's thank the speaker again.